Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is the Dry Cleaner Cast. Welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast, a podcast that takes a new look at the war on terror, its legacy, and espionage in the 21st century. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr.
On this month's Dry Cleaner Cast, we're joined by author Julia Ebner. We discuss her new book, The Rage, which looks at the vicious circle between far-right and Islamist extremists. Just a quick service announcement, this is the final episode of 2017. I just want to say a huge thank you to everybody who's been listening and supporting this podcast over the year. We will be returning in late January, and we have some very interesting guests coming up. So I want to wish you all happy holidays, and all the best for 2018. And don't forget to check out our website, www.drycleanercast.co.uk. On there you'll find links to past episodes, you'll also find links to books from some of the authors that we've interviewed, and on our blog we have some suggestions for some spy-related presents for spy buffs within your family. I hope you enjoy this month's episode.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
Julia, welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
It's great to have you. Before we begin, can you just tell us a sort of bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, which is a London-based counter-extremism organization. We do projects on the ground, but also do a lot of research. And my focus is mainly cumulative extremism, the relationship between Islamist and far-right extremism, and also what the new strategies of the extreme right movements are globally. And my background is in my bachelor, I did philosophy and international business. I then did a master's in China. It's actually quite far from the topic I'm currently dealing with, but it was in Chinese politics and international relations. Yeah. And then I shifted my focus more to the Middle East to focus on jihadism and Middle Eastern history at a degree at LSE, the London School of Economics. Yeah. And then I went to join the first counter-extremism think tank, Quilliam, and I worked there for a couple of years before then joining ISD and publishing my book last month.
Yeah, so you've written this fantastic book called The Rage that looks at the relationship between Islamist extremists and the Western far right. Can you just give us a sort of brief overview of the book and why you felt it was important to write it?
Yeah, so I started writing this book, it was in the week of June 2016 when the Orlando attack happened in the gay nightclub carried out by a jihadist. And a few days after that, Jo Cox was murdered, the British Labour MP was murdered here in the UK, and I just felt that I could see this rise, working for Quilliam at that time, I could see this simultaneous rise in both Islamist and far-right extremist attacks, and I was wondering what the relationship was between the two. And one of the things that I found most worrying is that, in fact, terrorist attacks themselves are scary, but more importantly is, or the bigger threat of terrorism is what they cause in the aftermath and how they rip apart our societies. And that's one of the things I really wanted to look into, and also how the interaction and the symbiotic relationship that I could see between far-right and Islamist extremism, kind of provoking each other into more violent action and helping each other's narratives. Yeah. So I looked into that a bit deeper in that research.
Yeah, brilliant. What's the reaction been to the book so far?
That's a good question. I think there were a lot of different reactions. I mean, it was quite well received across the political spectrum, but interestingly and not surprisingly, I had quite a few very negative reactions from the extreme fringes, with far-right extremists saying, "Oh, well, the bit about Islamist extremism is, I mean, is good, but the bit about the far right is complete crap, which is of course natural. And I had the other from the other side, from the Islamist extremist side, it would be the same. I think it's probably, I hope that this means that at least I'm trying to keep a balance between the two and to keep a consistent approach across all forms of extremism. So I was expecting to get criticized on from both sides. Yeah,
they kind of say that if you're upsetting someone, you're doing something right, aren't you?
Yeah, hopefully. Well, I'm still waiting for the negative endorsements, and maybe I'm going to put them on the back of my book next to the more middle ground positive quotes.
So I'd like to go into the far right and Islamist extremists and what they believe. Let's start by looking at the far right. Can you just sort of give us a sort of dummy's guide, if you will, to the ideas of the far right and the origins of those ideas?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting on the far right is that there is, of course, not one coherent ideology. But what is common, what most of the today's far right movements have in common, and in general extreme right groups have in common, is that narrative of an ongoing or an imminent, inevitable war between races or cultures. And then you get elements to different ideological elements to different degrees, such as nationalism, racism, xenophobia, anti-democracy, advocacy for a strong state. And that's according to the definition, for example, that Cass Mudd, the far right expert, gave. But what's interesting nowadays is that we see a split between the European far-right movements, which are mostly the counter-jihad movement and the Nouvelle Droite intellectual movement that came from France, which are a lot more focused on the cultural aspects, these dividing lines along culture and the ethno-cultural divisions, and not so much on race. And in the US, it's much more focused on race, so the alt-right, for example. And then you get, in addition to that, both in the US and in Europe, you get the traditional neo-Nazis who would have all of these elements and very strong anti-Semitic elements. But it's what I found fascinating in a way and very disturbing is that often the transition is it's very blurry. Sometimes the lines get very blurred between anti-immigration and Islamophobia, which is present in all of the far-right groups, for example, we examined in our report at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. We found elements of these, but then often they get carried into the more anti-Semitic, racist echo chambers. And what often starts as anti-immigration views quickly transforms into something more extreme, and that is then fundamentally racist and anti-Semitic. And yeah, I think now we're seeing a renaissance of some of the ideas that are not new, can be traced back to centuries ago. We already had anti-Semitism, but we really see that people are rereading ideologues also that inspired fascism, like Julius Evola, for example. So it's interesting to see how, I think it was to a certain degree probably a combination of the migration crisis, of terrorism, that since the millennial turn, we saw a renaissance of some degree of some old ideas, but a rebranding of those ideas, and really a resurfacing of some of the far-right ideologies that we saw in the 20th century.
Yeah, and have you, are there any, sorry, it's a bit of a strange question, but I mean, have you seen any evidence of kind of like different countries or sort of financing or pushing certain agendas? As people talk about potential financial links to Russia and the rise of the far right in Europe, and then you've got like in America, you have sort of evangelical Christians and how the far right sort of attach themselves to sort of that message and things like that.
Yeah, so there are different things to say about that. I think one of the most interesting opportunistic alliances comes from the fact that, of course, Russia and far-right groups across Europe and the US all try to destabilize Europe or to reshuffle the cards so that they can benefit from a new kind of a new order. And I think that's something they have in common. So of course, there was, we saw a lot of Russian influence in some of the far-right operations carried out online. Also some of the financial support, mostly for far-right political parties. There's also an increasing degree of collaboration across borders, also between US groups and European groups. And I found that is something that really unites, I think, Islamist extremists and far-right extremists, but also Russia, that this goal of destabilizing Europe. And that's also something where we see this inadvertent collaboration and, or not purposeful, not explicit collaboration, not always, but in a way they feed off one another or they work towards common goals. And that's also one of the parallels I could find.
Yeah. Well, you're mentioning it just now, but what is the ultimate goal of the far right and how do they envisage achieving that goal?
So for most of them, it's purely to shift the Overton window, or that's the first strategic goal, to shift the Overton window so that what's acceptable in public discourse further to the right, and to really push political parties and the establishment into adopting stricter measures towards immigration, Islam. So there are cosmetic differences between the different groups in terms of their goals, but most of them would want completely secured borders and the kind of bringing back all the refugees and migrants to the countries that they originally came from, and then the strategies differ. Some of them would adopt political means, others would adopt activism, and then of course there's those who adopt violent means to reach those goals.
Now, online spaces are playing an important part in the world of the far right. The online world is a sort of curious blend of subcultures, from anti-feminists to those gamer groups to conspiracy theorists. Yet these groups don't actively promote extremism, but they appear to be sort of fertile ground for the alt-right to hijack these groups as their topics sort of naturally align. Can you just talk to us about how important the online world is to the far right and promoting its ideas?
Yeah, hugely important. So within the last few years, there has been an increasing convergence on some of the online platforms, especially on some of the messaging boards like 4chan, 8chan, where groups who sometimes weren't even political in the first place, but kind of found a common ground in their increasing grievances towards the political establishment, towards progressive ideas, towards what they would call the globalist elites, the left, but also feminism. And it's interesting to see all of these different fringe groups, and sometimes it was the conspiracy theorists, but sometimes there were elements of gamer communities who had a grievance against feminists. But also then groups who would just talk about immigration a lot, how they would come together in the run-up to the US election and really have that common goal of bringing Trump, who would unite all of these groups in a way, because he was appealing to the more misogynic but also the anti-immigration and some of the conspiracy theorists as well. So he was really able to unite these groups, which made them coalesce even more around common ideas and increasingly adopt a common kind of a common ideology as well.
Yeah. And those words like the elite or globalist come up so often, especially around the Brexit debate last year and the election of Trump as well.
Yeah, it's part of, so that's also what I meant when I said sometimes the anti-immigration views, or that also lead to conspiracy theories about there is an ongoing Muslim invasion of Europe, how these then often move into the more, or move towards conspiracy theories that would say, oh, actually there is an ongoing white genocide and it's orchestrated by the globalist Jewish elites. So there's this evolution of conspiracy theories that build up and get, of course, in these online fringe platforms are kind of reinforced because of this effect of creating huge echo chambers, global echo chambers, where all these conspiracy theories are shared, fake news is shared, and they have started creating their own alternative platforms, because now increasingly they have been kicked off by from the popular mainstream platforms, especially after the Charlottesville rally. And now they set up their own media platforms, their own crowdsourcing platforms, but also, and financial structures, but also their own chats and political forums. So it's interesting how these online, almost parallel societies form. Yeah. And mean, not it's I wouldn't say that all of this is necessarily a bad thing, but there are definitely some dangerous trends within those fringe platforms.
And two people who always seem to come up in the conspiracy theories that I've seen online is usually criticism of Angela Merkel, how somehow she's, you know, sold Europeans and Germans down the river, or George Soros, who apparently is financing everything at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the two favorite topics are Merkel as an example of the failed, her failed immigration policies, the failed what they would call cultural Marxism, but also George Soros as the example of a Jewish billionaire philanthropic investor who would, according to them, be behind that white genocide.
Yeah. Well, if George Soros is listening, if he goes to patreon.com/drycleanercast, donations are welcome. But anyway, you mentioned in your book that the most successful online groups tend to have an effective street wing. Can you just give us a guide to some of these groups who exist in the UK and their international links?
Yeah, in the UK we have nowadays a very splintered far-right landscape because all of the big movements, and it's true that in the past most of the successful movements really combined online and offline activism, such as the EDL, Pegida, and I think to a certain extent we have seen novel approaches now, because now, for example, Generation Identity, which originally formed in Europe and has wings, has offshoots all across Europe, is also in the process now of setting up a UK branch. And they are really good at launching media stunts, generating a lot of attention from the media, and but also leading information operations online. And I think and they're also increasingly learning from the alt-right. And then, of course, you would also get the more militant groups like National Action, which then operated under its alliances NS131 and Scottish Dawn, and which is really organized training camps that were modeled after ISIS training camps, and had a lot of similarities again with the Islamist militant groups and with the jihadist groups. Mm. But yeah, I think increasingly now. And that is true for all across the world, but especially also for the UK. We see transatlantic cooperation. We see loose networks that are no longer, not all of the far-right sympathizers are members of specific groups now, but because the internet has really facilitated cooperation online, they more often would kind of share common goals and mobilize around these common goals, or coordinate around specific events and then come together offline for specific events.
Because before the online, they were quite fringe, and I suppose they were having to do mail outs and have physical meetups, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And there are still a lot of groups who do that because it's often necessary in order to have a strong group identity. I think this offline dimension is fundamental to maintaining that. But yeah, there is definitely an exchange of knowledge across borders and a mobilization within those fringe platforms, and also encrypted messaging apps that are that sometimes see members from across the world kind of cooperate on information operations, PSYOP style.
Yeah, I mean, these people are not idiots. I think I was reading in your report that they've been using, information that's come out about like GCHQ online tactics and the intelligence services.
They're hugely sophisticated. They have even used some of the leaked government documents against their own governments to influence elections. So it's interesting to see how they translate this online, their strength in mobilizing people online, into real world impact through that.
Mm. And I suppose, if they want to get into the mainstream, they need to put on a sort of respectable face.
Well, yeah, they often camouflage some more extreme ideas behind their public face, which tries to be politically correct. Mm. And that's that's their explicit strategy that they would talk about in these encrypted messaging apps when they speak about how to infiltrate the mainstream, how to kind of what they would call red pill the normies, so kind of radicalized the normal people on the mainstream internet and social media platforms. They're quite good at that, and I think they've sensed that there is a potential, there's a niche to be filled, especially within the platforms that younger people use, and they've been really good at galvanizing younger people, especially Generation Z, which grew up after 9/11. I think that's also something we see on both sides, on the Islamist and on the far right extremist side, that these younger generations born after this war on terror started have been more susceptible to ideologies on both sides. I think because they don't know the world before 9/11, basically.
I think of a lot of political movements, people don't always necessarily know the historical context of things, and they're just sort of seeing the information presented them to in the present. One interesting term you just mentioned, political correct, it's a term that kind of comes up a lot, I've noticed, on these online debates, should we say the respectable side of the far right. People, like when we talk about sort of Islamist extremism and things like that, and we try and get into the nuances of that, people criticize experts as being just politically correct. This term comes up a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's this whole backlash against what is perceived as politically overcorrect, the politically overcorrect establishment, and this effort to break taboos, to explicitly use these politics of transgression, especially on the internet. That was initially some of the things started as jokes and really just a lot of people were fed up with always having to use politically correct terms, and I think that generated a movement or different movements that are that want to, in a way, find it cool or hip to revolt against this sense of political correctness.
Yeah, and it's sort of tapping into that natural, and it's a bit of a cliche, but that natural feeling of rebellion in younger people, teenagers and things like that.
Yeah, and that's also why I think some of the far-right groups have really been able to resonate well with the German youth, because especially within the German context, because of course, Germany's history, there has been a very strong sense of this political correctness, of a lot of taboos that these younger generations are now trying to break. And that's why when looking at Germany specifically, but of course also that is also true for the US, especially on the topic of race, for example, in the US, that has had a lot of appeal to some people to break these taboos.
And that particularly came out during Trump's election, like with Pepe, is it Pepe the Frog?
Yes.
And meme culture and all that.
I mean, that's the thing, the weaponization of culture is something that the alt-right has really mastered quite well, and a lot better, unfortunately, than any of the counter-responses that have been given so far. So it's interesting to see that for the first time now we see a counterculture emerging from the right rather than from the left. Traditionally, all the cool movements or counterculture movements came from the left, or those that resonated with young people. Mm. And now there seems to be a bit of a lag, there seems to be a bit of a time lag in the response that is provided from the middle ground or from the left, in order to also provide a balanced, a counterculture to the counterculture in a way.
Yeah, I suppose at the moment, I think liberals on the left feel like they're the ones who are trying to protect normalcy or whatever, and so they're probably now being seen as a little bit out of step with this sort of sense of change that everybody seems to want, but no one seems to better define exactly what change it is they do want.
I think there is a lot of potential to tap into some of. I think there are a lot of potentially. I think often you it's necessary to use humor or to use culture in order to get people motivated around common goals, because now there doesn't seem to be anything or nothing that can match the sophistication of the alt-right, definitely.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. That's patreon.com/DryCleanerCast.
Let's have a quick look at Islamist extremism, because we don't want to forget them either. I don't want them to feel left out. So this year, unfortunately, we've witnessed a large number of terrible ISIS-inspired terrorist attacks, both in London, Manchester, and European cities such as Barcelona and Paris, just to name a few. And also in October, Kenya suffered one of its most deadly attacks, in which 300 people were killed by a truck bomb detonated by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Like the far right, there are multiple Islamist groups that share an ideology and a common goal. Can you just talk us through the various Islamist groups that currently exist and what their main aims are and how they sort of differ from one another?
Yeah, of course.
Not an easy question.
Especially for a limited time, could go on for hours. But just maybe in very briefly, I would say that the two movements that are still operating on an international level, that have international relevance, are, of course, Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. And then there are tons of regional movements that are often affiliated to or in alliance with those two organizations. But, for example, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Al-Nusra Front, which now recently changed its name to HTS, operating mostly in Syria, and then various, as I said, multiple other groups. But I think the ideological differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, for example, and most of the groups in most of the jihadist groups are rather cosmetic, but their strategic approach to reaching this goal of establishing a caliphate is very different. So, for example, one of the differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda is that ISIS decided to immediately establish a caliphate, while Al-Qaeda saw that more as a long-term strategic goal. And now they are really competing for influence, especially as Al-Qaeda is growing stronger, Islamic State, at least territorially, is growing weaker. They have been competing for regional influence, but also for global recruits. And I think the two main threats now are that Al-Qaeda affiliated movements, or in general, Al-Qaeda has really benefited from this disproportionate or this almost exclusive focus on the threat from ISIS on the side of the international community. And that is something where Al-Qaeda might step up their efforts in the close future and might actually make use of the networks that they have been able to rebuild in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And some security experts are saying that they are now stronger than pre-9/11. Mm-hmm. And of course, with the son of Osama bin Laden, Hamza bin Laden now, there might be a completely new approach or a new wave of Al-Qaeda-inspired attacks as well. That is definitely one of the threats, I think, to keep in mind. The other major threat, I think, is that now that ISIS has lost most of its territory, its ideological appeal shouldn't be underestimated. So because they still have quite a good, especially online, they're still operating in most of the Telegram encrypted messaging apps. They're across different languages and different regions. I'm in many of their German-speaking, but also French-speaking, English-speaking channels, and they're still quite good at, even though they get shut down online, they're still good at spreading their ideas and radicalizing people across the world. And so I think it's always important to keep in mind that the end of ISIS, territorially speaking, wouldn't mean the end of ISIS-inspired terrorism, and even less so the end of international jihadism.
Yeah, sadly, it kind of reminds me. They kind of, in my mind, I see them sort of turning into almost like a PLO or Black September type group, like we saw in the sort of 70s. And what was interesting about those kind of groups, they had a lot of popular sort of European support as well.
Yeah, there's. I think in general, there's so much we can learn from different movements throughout history. This is all not a novel. I mean, terrorism isn't really a new trend. And I think we don't have to, also when countering it, we can probably learn from some of the history and don't have to reinvent the wheel. I think that there's definitely a strategic shift as well that we see in regards to the use of, or there might be a shift in regards to the use of women because what over the summer what happened was that ISIS for the first time released in their propaganda magazine Ramia a justification, a theological justification of the use of women in combatant roles as well. So that might also mean that they move away from their very traditional primary, secondary roles of women as wives and as mothers and sometimes as propaganda instruments towards a more active role also in staging terrorist attacks, in taking up combatant roles. I think that's a sign of weakness, but that might also pose a severe threat to global security.
Yeah, and I'm from a former interview I was just doing with Tony McMohan just a few weeks ago, he was talking about the importance of women in communities and actually combating extremism at the moment, and maybe do Islamic State and other groups sort of acknowledge that, and this is maybe why they're targeting women now.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is really something that we will also at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue increasingly look into over the next few months, how this develops and what the new trends are that we can see here.
Yeah. Well, can you just give us a brief, as brief as you can, not easy this one, but can you give us a brief history of the ideas of Islamist extremists and what they, you know, their ideology, what is it that they actually believe?
Yeah, well, that's an even bigger question, but yeah, definitely. There's, I would say that in the late, 20th century, but also the late 19th century, has really seen that emergence of political Islam. Sometimes they, of course, draw on ideologues that go as far back as to the 13th century, with Ibn Taymiyyah being one of the first ideologues that that were even quoted in the 9/11 commission report to have inspired Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Because back then there was the Mongol invasion, and so he issued a fatwa that would for the first time really justify a jihad against the Muslim rulers who were converts back then. But he would a lot of his thoughts also on this ignorance of these Muslim rulers would then inspire jihadists nowadays. And to a similar degree, I think some of the 20th century ideologues like Qutb with his book Milestones really provided a lot of inspiration for Al-Qaeda, but also for ISIS. And it's probably this backlash that was created after the Enlightenment values were spread throughout the colonized world, and this backlash against Western influence that brought this resurgence of political Islam, or this really this that made it flourish. And while Ibn Taymiyyah would be called the ideological godfather, I think Assam, for example, who really was influential in the first Afghanistan war against the Soviet invasion, brought together a lot of jihadist fighters from across the world. So he was called the father of global jihad and of this transnational jihad against foreign forces. And so I think there are several ideologues. Maududi is another one who would provide this idea of that man-made law shouldn't be acceptable, and that Muslims have to fight against any forms of man-made law, or bid'ah, again being the concept of innovation within Islam.
You've stated in your book that the ultimate goal of Islamist extremist groups is to provoke civil wars that destabilize the current world order. By creating more fear and outrage, they can divide, they can drive societies apart and exacerbate existing tensions. Can you just talk to us a bit about that?
I think the ultimate goal of any terrorist group, because they're always in the weaker position, because in this asymmetric warfare, they have to stage something that would provoke their opposite side into taking disproportionate action that might completely reshuffle the cards. So their ultimate goal is to create chaos, and that's apparent in all of the strategy documents from different terrorist organizations, but most notably here is probably the Al-Qaeda, the management of savagery, their 2020 plan, where they would want to provoke a global civil war between Muslims and non-Muslims until 2020. They would want this final battle to happen that also builds on this end of times prophecy that where they think that the end of times is coming and there will be a final battle happening in Dabiq, and that will lead to the end of what they would call the global oppression of Muslims by the West. And this idea of these two monolithic blocks, the West and Islam, being in opposition to each other and having to come to some form of conflict where one or the other will win, that's something that is inherent, again, to both Islamists and far-right extremists who would see this race or culture war happening and would want to accelerate that. So that's also the reason for staging terrorist attacks, is not solely to harm the enemy physically, but really to break apart their democratic structures, to cause chaos, to benefit from this from the societal backlash that it creates and from all the rifts that they can create.
Now, in your book, you make a very important point that most Muslims are not Islamists, and that most Islamists are not jihadists. Can you just talk about why these distinctions are important?
I think it's hugely important to make a distinction between, 99% of all Muslims living in the West aren't jihadists and aren't even Islamists. So Islamism is the politicized version of the religion of Islam. It's a political ideology that is, again, inspired by these different political ideologues, mostly of the 20th century. But then the goal of most Islamists would be to create, to establish a caliphate, sometimes a global caliphate, and to impose Sharia law, or one version of Sharia law. And the way in which Islamists want to reach their goals, that is where it depends if they can be considered jihadists or not. So most of the Islamists aren't jihadists because they would just simply want to reach that goal by using dawah, by using missionary. Trying to convince people through missionary work. But jihadists would then resort to more violent means and would use terrorist attacks, would use martyrdom operations to do that.
So yeah, like the far right, the online world plays an important role for Islamist extremist groups to gain supporters. It's reported that around 850 people from the UK have gone out to join ISIS. Can you just talk to us about how Islamist groups use the internet to gain supporters?
Yeah, they have most often now, because they have been shut down on most of the mainstream social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook, have really stepped up their efforts to shut down any accounts that would try to lure people into the arms of extremists and any of the propaganda that is being spread. But they are still operating on Telegram, on some platforms that can be used to spread propaganda. And often it starts with an online contact, but then it might, there are a lot of different pathways into extremism. There isn't one sole way of recruiting people, but often it starts with online contact and would then be coupled with offline contact in public institutions where they would have a charismatic recruiter that can tap into some of the grievances of young people and link them to basically explaining them by using their narratives and using their ideologies the global oppression of Muslims, and then saying, oh, and that's why it's necessary to fight back in the form of a jihad, and that's why it's necessary for Muslims to unite against the West. Mm-hmm. So that's then the arguments that they bring both online in Telegram, where they show pictures of Muslims worldwide being, they always would use examples also of course, of the ongoing war in Syria, where civilians are killed, showing pictures of children being killed, but also using examples of discrimination of Muslims in their home countries. And that's where they can definitely use some of the far-right violence to make a point about the whole West being, again, generalizing this and saying, actually, these far-right extremists are just the real face of the West.
Yeah, and these Islamist groups, they're not like Four Lions, where they're a bunch of have a go, what's the word I want now, you know, sort of lucky-go-happy jihadists who just happen to kind of botch together a plot whilst managing to kill members of their own team. I mean, these are quite sophisticated individuals and groups, and like the far right, there are groups that like to put a respectable face on the kind of on the ideology that informs these groups, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. They're in a way, I mean, they're all very good at being at mainstreaming, and they have all very clear strategies. Also, the Islamist extremists talk about how they would be able to convert the what they would call the gray zone Muslims, the Muslims that don't support ISIS, which are most of the Muslims. How they would be able to get them to support the causes of ISIS or of jihadists, and that's exactly where they actually like the fact that Trump was elected. They like the fact that far right extremists staged that rally in Charlottesville because they can use all this as an example to show, oh, actually the whole West is racist. Actually, just look at what happened in, now I saw a message on Telegram of an ISIS-affiliated group, a German-speaking one, where they were saying, well, if you look at the results in the German election, you see that every seventh person voted for the far right AfD, who would want to guess. Basically, they think that every fifth native German, because if you deduct the immigrants from that number, they would think that they even said then you can see you can look at people on the street and you can count to five and see that every fifth person wants to kill you.
Wow.
So that's how they frame
it.
Yeah, they put it that way, which is of course also an exaggeration. Mm. But yeah, that is something where they are very good at tapping into the grievances that exist anyways in our societies. And if these societal rifts become bigger and if these tensions become more severe, I think there is potential on both sides of actually turning this prophecy of this inevitable war, which seems completely absurd, but of turning that into something more likely. And yeah, that is the danger.
A self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, both far-right groups and Islamist groups kind of use and thrive on this clash of civilizations narrative. Can you just talk to us about this narrative and its importance to both groups?
Yeah, that's exactly, I think, the problem is that I don't, so if enough people believe that there is a fundamental clash of civilizations, this might turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's not really that there is necessarily one, but it all depends on how many people are convinced on both sides to join the what they believe are the groups that fight for their own identity, their cultural or racial identity. And the problem is with forming these monolithic blocks that are opposed to each other, and by mainstreaming some of these ideologies, they might actually get to a point where this turns into some form of conflict that is exactly what both groups want. And I think that's why the clash of civilization plays a huge role in both of the in both ideologies, and both want to mainstream this narrative of this inevitable war.
Now, can we just talk a little bit about the pathway to extremism? It appears that both the far right and Islamist extremists, as we're saying, thrive online, and they're increasingly drawing in young people and in some cases older people as well. Are there similarities in the types of people who are drawn to extremism and the way in which they become actively engaged?
Yes, there are definitely common elements and patterns across the different profiles and radicalization pathways. Although having said that, of course, it really varies from individual to individual on both sides. But I think that often on both sides you would have similar pull and push factors, and the push factors are very often identity crises of some form, either not feeling like you can be Muslim and British at the same time, but on the far right side it would often be the feeling that the West is, or their home country is, being run over by immigrants. They don't really know anymore what actually their identity is. And then also grievances or frustrations about both domestic policies, but also having and also foreign policies, but also having this sense of being discriminated against, being humiliated by the other. There's a lot of, in both of the networks or movements, that where I went to undercover to do some of the interviews and to see what they say about the other. They spoke a lot about this, about how the other side treats their women. So both were thinking that actually their women were being taken away by the other side. The Islamist extremists would have emphasized the role of the West in sometimes even soldiers, sometimes raping their women, or also they spoke a lot about the oppression of their women. And the same was true, of course, for the far right networks, who would emphasize the Islamist extremists or Muslims in general. That's what they would say, are all part of these Muslim grooming gangs. They're raping our women. They're again, the emphasis then on they're raping our white Western women.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of, you know, from Breitbart to InfoWars, who always show these articles, and you have no idea who they're really sourced from, about like how immigrants are raping women. It's or like in swimming pools, or I don't know, there's loads of places. It just seems to be constantly rapes going on, and it's
So there are a lot of push factors that they have in common, but on the pull factor side, I think we also see a lot of common elements, such as these utopian visions that can be quite appealing to people, that show, oh, there could be a world with only whites or only non-Muslims, or there could be a world with only Muslims, and that is the ultimate solution to all of the problems we're facing. And to sometimes really it can be, I think, quite appealing to a lot of people to have a more have simple solutions to this hugely complex world, and that would provide just one solution for all the problems.
And that's what gives them sort of traction, because if you can say in one sentence something needs to be said in a book, it's obviously going to win in the one sentence, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Well, it's so much more, that's also why tweets are so much more effective I mean, Trump can put everything into a one-liner and get a huge amount of support for that, because it's also a lot more simple to...
Here's a generalization, but with online culture, from what I have seen as a user myself, the most extreme messages, the most controversial things tend to gain traction and go viral. You know, it always seems to be some sort of position like that will get more attention than a more nuanced position.
Yeah, that's also the problem. That's also where the media comes into all of this. Because the media, of course, now is really struggling to keep up with the whole 24 hours news loops and with news circles, with all the alternative media platforms that are emerging right now, and where they have to compete with all of that and compete for clicks and baits. And I think that's something where, of course, sensationalist reporting and reporting in a very, sometimes oversimplifying things can be more attractive to people. And that's where I think, especially when talking about terrorism, there's a need to really maintain a high level of nuance.
Yeah. I mean, there is a danger of normalizing, especially in the UK, normalizing sort of positions of the far right, like the anti-immigration headlines, you know, or the focus on hijabs, or I don't know, the various scams involving halal meat, or all these ideas of the Islamification of British society. Yeah. These are all things that end up in publications like the Daily Mail, which I would never really particularly call a respectable magazine, but it is sold. You know, it's not like Stormfront. You know, it's a paper
that you'll... mainstream.
It is. It's a mainstream paper. You'll see it at your checkouts, and those headlines sow seeds, don't they?
Yeah, and the biggest problem is that then often the lines get very much blurred between what's actually a security problem. What is related to terrorism? I mean, hijabs or not, that's not even a security problem. That is, but often it gets all mixed up with the debate about terrorism, responses to terrorism, we have to ban the burqa. That doesn't have anything to do with it, actually. That's a cultural question. That's a question that is a legitimate one to ask, but it doesn't have anything to do with security. And I think that's really important to stress, because otherwise it all, in the heads of people who read that, it might just become actually a way of saying conservative Islam is the same as Islamist extremism, which exactly... brings us back to that essential distinction between the two.
Definitely. So is it possible for people who have turned to extremism to change?
Yes, I had a lot of really great people that I interviewed for the book as well, who I found very inspiring, because they were telling me about how they could turn their backs to extremism. And of course, it's always usually it's a long process that takes a lot of courage, because they would basically use all of their social network. Because of course, often extremist movements kind of replace almost the family systems, the environments, even the friends, and provide a sense of belonging. So I think with a lot of support from policy, from intervention providers, from people who would stay also open-minded and treat them as human beings, I think it is possible. And that applies to both Islamist and far-right extremists. I think it's necessary to take a very human approach to that. And I think it is possible for them to leave these networks. And it is possible for us to encourage that by not completely dehumanizing them and treating them like objects, because they're not.
The reason why I ask that question is because, especially today and today's online culture, there's a growing sense that you just can't get through to people who have different sort of polarizing views. And, you know, we've all been there where we've, you know, you've tried to chat with a relative who, you know, is espousing all sorts of stuff, and you just can't get through to them, or there's somebody you don't even know online who takes a totally different opinion to you. So it is possible for people to change. And, you know, what is sort of, in a sense, the best strategy to help people change if they are sort of going into an extremist position?
I think there are several different ways to do that. I mean, there are some really good intervention providers in the UK, and there are some really good initiatives, both from coming from NGO sides, but also from the government Prevent program, which is very controversial, but which has a lot of good elements in there. It's not always perfectly implemented, but I think that especially working with former extremists with psychologists who would know very well what the processes are, it's really important to very carefully select which people would carry out these interventions and these de-radicalization processes. But often also at Institute for Strategic Dialogue, we found that former extremists, we also have a network of former extremists, can be very effective in both doing the one-to-one interventions, doing mentoring, but also having counter speech campaigns online that would maybe first get into, if they reach the target audience, really get to extremists who would think, oh, actually there are some people who manage to leave the networks without having huge social costs to it. And it is possible to continue life after hate, which is one of the campaign's names. But yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. And that social cost, I mean, that's a very important thing, because, I mean, I don't know if you know, I was a former conspiracy theorist, and there was a big social side that. Yeah. if you listen to episode 8, we talk a bit about that. But there's a big... It becomes part of your social circle. You start meeting like-minded people, and it becomes very hard to leave that group, or to say the ideology that led you to that group, because then everybody around you starts to treat you differently, and it's very strange, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly. But that's exactly, I think, why it would be. It's helpful. Things like even Humble brings. He was a former EDL regional coordinator. Brings some of the far right people that he still knows, or that are in his network and in his environment, takes them to mosques and shows them around there, and introduces them to Muslims, so that they would meet real people and not just have these online conspiracy theories and be in those self-reinforcing echo chambers.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to, again, take a very human approach, because in the end, that's also why I wanted to do the book with this very human angle and show the different pathways of individuals and really understand what's driving them and speak to them directly rather than just write about them without really understanding what drives them.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's hugely important to treat this very sensitive topic as a very human one.
No, I mean, it's our humanity, it's got us into this, and it'll be our humanity that gets us out, I believe.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah. Yeah, so you've mentioned that both Islamists and far-right extremists have benefited from the global rise in identity politics. Can you just talk us through how this is so?
So the problem with identity politics and with the rise of people like Trump, of people like far-right populists in Europe, Marine Le Pen, or the AfD party leaders, the leaders of the Austrian Freedom Party, is that they all represent or spread and propagate the same ideological fundamentals that are then fueling both far-right and Islamist extremists. And that is, again, dividing the world into generalized or monolithic blocks that are in a conflict with each other. In most of the cases, it's the West and Islam. But I think by spreading these very much cultural or racial identity-based viewpoints of or to see the world in these very binary terms, they would really feed into both sides. And then, of course, the media also plays a role in amplifying these narratives by picking up all of the all of what they say, and then it's being used in the. So sometimes now Islamist extremists would use some of what Trump says. Of course, they've really celebrated that Trump got elected in the night of the elections. I was monitoring the ISIS Telegram channels, and they were celebrating precisely because they knew he was going to drive polarization even further and in the States. And the same is true for European identity politics. All extremists want to see is increased polarization, because that means that everyone has to take a side, and they hope that people will take their side, but it's beneficial in any case to see the middle ground vanishing.
Yeah, which is then helps them with their goal of, you know, trying to destabilize our societies.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So
Well, so we've sort of touched upon this, but the language that we use as individuals when debating terrorism and its causes is an important issue. And for example, after an Islamist terrorist attack, opportunist politicians and right-wing press like to engage in anti-Muslim and anti-immigration rhetoric. And this rhetoric sort of demonizes minorities, it normalizes hate, and it can fuel white supremacism. And likewise, that same anti-Muslim rhetoric can be used as proof by Islamist extremists that the West is fundamentally racist and at war with Islam. In an increasingly polarized landscape, both online and our social spaces, it's getting increasingly harder for ordinary people to discuss their shock and disgust at both Islamist extremists and far-right extremist actions. How can we challenge both of these extreme groups without falling into the trap of furthering this idea of a clash of civilizations?
Yeah, I think one of the major solutions to that is, first of all, starting by adopting a very consistent approach towards all forms of extremism. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware that in my book, I speak mainly about the dynamics and the parallels between Islamist and far-right extremism. Of course, there are other forms of extremism. There might be far-left extremism. There might be other religiously inspired or, Christian extremism or anti-LGBT extremism. There are all forms of extremism that should be talked about in very similar ways, and in a consistent way should also be tackled by both policymakers, tech companies, and also the way civil society kind of goes back against them by showing civil intolerance, not necessarily always having stricter laws, but I think it's really necessary for civil society to show this is not okay and challenge this both online and offline. In the same way that now homophobia would be countered by civil society or would be considered a complete taboo, I think it's necessary to make some of the extreme ideologies or the extreme ideas propagated by Islamist extremists or far-right extremists, to make those taboo or uncool. And having that consistency across all boards, and also adopted in the media in terms of the language that is being used when talking about terrorist incidents. There was a big inconsistency when talking about Islamist violence, Islamist-inspired violence, which is then always called immediately terrorism, whereas far-right extremist-inspired violence would often just be referred to as murder or mass shootings, stabbings. And I think that has caused almost a backlash from both sides, because it really meant that some of the people on the Islamist extremist side, or even just Muslims, would think, oh, this is actually unfair if everything that is being committed by Muslims is called terrorism, whereas on the far right side, people would have there is a perceptual gap in the way terrorism is perceived, because most people have the impression that Islamist terrorism is a lot more common than far right terrorism. Mm-hmm. While in terms of frequency, actually far right terrorism happens more often in the US and in Europe, and is considered a major security threat across the UK, but also across Europe, especially in Germany. There have been a lot of attacks in the last couple of years against refugee camps, against a lot of people have also died from that, or attacks, major scale attacks, were foiled by the police. Yeah. That would have even involved sometimes explosives or weapons of mass destruction, with chemical and biological weapons being increasingly adopted on the far right extremist side as well. So I think that's one of the biggest points to start from, I think, is consistency. Yeah. Without that, we can't really combat either form of extremism because of this reciprocal or cumulative effect that it has.
Well, Julia, thank you so much for your time today. Before we wrap up, do you have any sort of final thoughts you'd like to share on anything that we've covered or something that we may have missed that's important to you?
Yeah, I think one of the things I'd like to stress is that I do believe that there is no reason for pessimism, because I'm aware that this is all a very dark topic. And one of the problems, first I'm going to say a few more words about the problem before coming to the positive side, but I think there's extremists have been early adopters of technology. They've been really ahead of us, and ahead of the curve, really, to make use of modern technology, or much better in their use of that. They have been much better than the middle ground to make use of, to really appeal to the younger generations, to create this counterculture, to weaponize culture for their own causes. And they have been better so far at transnational cooperation, knowledge sharing. So these are the three levels, I think, where they're a bit ahead of us. But I think there's a lot of potential, especially because there is so much motivation and so much increasingly also active activism coming from a very grassroots level of people from the middle ground who are motivated to counter that and to provide credible alternative narratives to the ones propagated by extremists. And I think that is something we should really make use of, and where it's necessary, I think, to not have purely government-led programs, but to let civil society get back, mend some of the divisions that have been caused, and really rebuild those bridges. But again, take a human approach to it and speak directly to the people, listen to the people who are vulnerable to the extremist ideologies, or who are already within extremist circles, to understand what drives them and to find appropriate measures to address that.
Brilliant. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
So either by buying my book,
which is a very good
that
book.
That would be the first recommendation. But otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter, Julie Rende, and you can also, you can find me on the ISD, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue webpage. We also just recently released our report on the transnational networks and global convergence of the extreme right. And we're going to continue work both on the ground with projects, but also through research.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter @DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a Dry Cleaner Cast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/drycleanercast. That's patreon.com/drycleanercast. Thanks for listening.